You are listening to Villanova University on iTunes U.
Thank you, Joe and Amanda, for that very nice introduction. And I just have to say I'm very honored and really having fun here at Villanova. This is a campus that I've heard so much about from Joe, and I've heard a lot of stories, so I'm very happy to meet so many of you today and have great conversations, which is what I like to do every place that I travel to. So, and Amanda is just absolutely fantastic because she's been to the Arctic. She actually knows some of the same people that I have met through my travels in Barrow, Alaska, and around that area. And I have just been talking to some of her, your students or grad students. What are you guys working on over here?
You're students and a postdoc.
Students and postdocs, so, and hopefully going to the Arctic to do research. And that's what I try to do, is have these conversations, share my story, inspire people, and get you just sort of fired up to learn more about the Arctic and hopefully have the opportunity to travel there. And I just have to say that I mentioned this over the lunchtime, but I knew I was on the right campus right away when I was asked when I walked into the luncheon room if I was a priest. So I just love it. And I also got in a little bit of trouble because I actually was at the Science March in Washington, D.C. this past weekend in the soaking rain. And I was proud and honored to march with the Georgetown faculty and a couple research folks I know there. And of course, you guys at Villanova just kind of poo-pooed me on my Georgetown connection. So I forget that there's these rivalries that I'm not used to because I come from sort of Big Ten country back in Iowa. And of course, if I was marching with a Michigan, you know, bunch of faculty or Ohio State or something, I would be in a lot of trouble also, being a University of Iowa person. So anyway, it's really great to be here with you. And I have a pretty unique story to share. And my path through life has been anything but straight. I would have been very honored and lucky to have attended Villanova. I went to the University of Nebraska at Omaha. And I was actually a collegiate football player, of all things, on scholarship there. But I was also a very good student. And the problem that I had as a student is that I love everything. Like, I'm a generalist as far as what I like, and that's what I found because I graduated with a double degree in exercise science, human performance, and also psychology and pre-med. So I had applied to graduate school in clinical psychology, graduate school in physical therapy, and medical school. So with that sort of confusing mix of things, I decided that the best thing to do was go ride my bicycle through New Zealand and take some time off and think about it. And that's what I did. And I guess I was talking to Joe on the way here from DC, and I really found my footing in this sort of school of life in the great outdoors. What I found when I was out on the road, I was learning more about how everything functioned than I did in the university setting. And for me, this was my big school. I discovered planet Earth. And this is where I love to spend my time, in the outdoors. And I decided that I wanted to be a professional documentary photographer and come back to the United States and do something different. And that's kind of what I've been doing ever since. And I'm so happy and lucky to have met Joe Robertson. We actually met in Minnesota and started speaking at the University of Minnesota campuses. And while we were traveling around, we both decided that we were explorers in this new era. Even though we were coming at it from two kind of different directions, we met right in the middle, because what we really decided that we understood was that we loved humanity and we wanted more positive outcomes, because we were seeing that we weren't getting these. Our current systems that we're trying to utilize to solve our problems just aren't working, whether it's politics, business, civics, These things have kind of broken down, and we're searching for new methodology, new ways to solve some of the world's problems, and especially climate, which seems to connect to every single thing that we do these days. And so with that, I'm going to kind of start here because I have a lot of slides, and I'm a photographer, so I love speaking through my images. And this is an image from the Arctic Ocean that I took 300 miles north of Point Barrow. And beautiful day sailing, 15-foot seas, running about 35 knots of wind, roughly 40 miles an hour, and a small craft advisory along the coast, which, as I always say, good sailing. So lovely day out there, and it makes for beautiful photography. And this is what drove me out there to sail the world's oceans, was to try to capture images that encapsulated the power and the spirituality that I feel out in nature that I couldn't find anywhere else. But I literally was born into the era of space exploration. I was born in 1959, and this was the era that manned flight into space took shape. And when I say I was born into it, I mean I was literally born into it. My father was a Marine Corps pilot. And in the lower right of the frame there, you can see Mercury capsule. My father worked on retrieving the capsules and the astronauts from outer space. And he was a helicopter pilot in the Marine Corps. And so this program began in 1959, which was the year of my birth. And so this is what my father did. He flew these old Sikorsky helicopters called the Seahorse. And so that's what they did. You think, what kind of the meaning, connotation of Seahorse is, they literally went out and picked things up out of the sea. And they sort of experimented with these helicopters on how they would actually go out there and pick up human beings after they plop down into the ocean and pull them back into the capsules. So this is kind of how I grew up and spent my childhood. And of course, here we are in Earth Week, and just spending Earth Day in Washington, D.C., and spending this whole week doing a lot of Earth Day activities. It was really this view from outer space of our little planet Earth, looking back and seeing this little blue marble, demonstrating our fragility of our little planet Earth, that spawned, created the environmental movement as we know it today, and Earth Day, and sort of what we feel now about this little planet. So this is how I grew up, in the race for space. But as a little boy, my backyard was the Des Moines River in a little town called Eldona, Iowa. And this was a time there weren't any screens, any of that kind of stuff. My parents didn't want me running around inside and terrorizing them. So basically they said, David, go outside and play and be back before dark, or be back for dinner. And that's how I grew up, creating my play space, trying to become an explorer by doing creative play in the outdoors, building forts, imagining that I was Davy Crockett or Daniel Boone or Huckleberry Finn, Tom Sawyer, all those kinds of folks that shaped my early life. But it was really the steep Blue Water Lake in northwest Iowa that was formed from a slow changing climate, right, a glacial lake. Natural climate change some 15,000 years ago, the glaciers receding carved these lakes out of the upper Midwest, and this formed what we call the Iowa Great Lakes. And we don't often stop to think about what it means to be a glacial lake. And to me, it means growing up and learning how to sail on a lake that was created by climate change. So it forms a natural connected circle that I would go off to sail the world's oceans and discover climate change face to face on the big waters of the Arctic Ocean. And this was a place that I've spent photographing. I continue to go back to. My wife and I have a home there, and it's always been a place of wonderment for me, of natural resources that are super high quality. And because we've maintained our water quality at very high levels, we have a super strong local economy. In a county of 17,000 people, we have a $275 million tourism economy. We're the only county in the state of Iowa, out of 99 counties, that has this. tourism-based economy. And it's because we've maintained our natural resources and not turned them into intensive row cropped corporate agriculture and animal confinements, which the rest of the state has become. And these are some of the issues that got me interested in the environmental movement in the first place, of maintaining our water quality. High water quality means beautiful pictures. They attract migrating waterfowl like this great blue heron and white pelicans there in the background. And this is what I love to photograph when I'm there. And also high quality recreation. We have marathons and triathlons and all sorts of things going on where we utilize the water and the trails around the lakes. And that's one thing that I also promote, is healthy activities in the outdoors. If you're training, working out, walking in the outdoors, it's really good for one's soul and one's spirit, as we know. So this is how we roll in the lakes area in Iowa. A lot of people don't even know we have water, but we have a lot of really great activities going on all the time, and especially in the summer, where we have great bicycle rides. We have RAGBRAI that goes across the state of Iowa, the oldest and biggest bike ride in the United States. 25,000 riders rolling across the state of Iowa every summer from all across the world and the United States. So it's really fun. And point-to-point swims. We utilize our lakes for high-quality recreation, and it is the driver of our economy. And we work in a bipartisan manner. Republicans and Democrats, we don't care if you're a liberal or conservative. Everybody works to maintain water quality. So we kind of have a model of how to work together for a common cause to protect our environment. And I really think that that's what we need to do with climate also, which I'll get into a little further. But it was during this time when I was kind of growing up and becoming a photographer that I started learning more about the water cycle. And it was water quality that really got me into everything. Water quality was the driver of my environmental background, because I started understanding how weather systems would start rolling in across the country from the Pacific or out of the Gulf of Mexico. Big thunderstorms, big rains. Well, now the 1 to 2 inch rains, because of climate change, we have more water vapor that's held in the atmosphere. That water vapor gets dumped in superstorms. And we're now having the 1 to 2 inch rains being replaced by 6 to 10 inch rains. And our land cannot absorb that water, especially since most of our wetlands have now been drained. So now they've been tiled, and guess what happens to all that runoff, right? It runs out of fields, enters our nearest water supply, goes into our lakes, causing algae blooms, turning our lakes into hypoxic dead zones, and it continues. Sediments roll in into our lakes, hurting fish habitat and affecting everything. And of course, this is what we end up with when we don't take care of our water, and they become unusable, both for recreation and for wildlife. And of course, here's the eventual outcome. So people often ask me why I live in Iowa, and I've often wondered this myself. This is actually the reason why, because I want something to be done about this. If you look at Iowa, this land between the two rivers, right here, it is in the heart of this drainage network, away from the urban areas, but in the heart of farmland. And it is the drainage basin. It is a venous sort of network that is draining all of this nutrient and sediment pollution all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico and creating this hypoxic dead zone that we all know about and probably have studied now in some classes. So when I talk about climate change and this big overall system, again, it all begins with one tailpipe or one smokestack or one industrial part of our society that's contributing this carbon pollution into the atmosphere and eventually into the oceans. But you can't really see it, can you? You look up, you look outside today, you don't see carbon pollution. You don't see it in the sky. You don't see ocean acidification in our oceans when you necessarily look in the ocean. So we have to have tools in our toolbox, ways to illustrate this, and a good way for me to illustrate it is the Iowa situation with our water quality. Because we now have 750 imperiled bodies of water in the state because of our intensive industrial agriculture. And one by one, these farms contribute to this problem that we see in the Gulf of Mexico. So if you're looking for tools, there's different ways to help describe what we're seeing with the climate situation. And as I say too, another good one is the plastic situation. Sort of one by one, these plastic containers that are one and done, we think they maybe they're all getting recycled, but they don't. And since 70% of the world's population lives within 100 miles of the ocean, that's 5 billion people, many of these plastics are now going into the ocean, and that's billions and billions of plastics every year. Containers that end up in the ocean, they end up in the gyres, and they're creating all the problems with like the North Pacific garbage patch. So there's ways to illustrate a lot of the problems with climate through using other tools in the toolbox. So for you young people and educators, this is a really good way to help illustrate. But my story really begins with sailing, because these are the tools, the vehicles that I've used to go explore the world's oceans. This is Lake Okoboji, and this was a national championship regatta that we held last summer in 2016. These are little X boats, and this is what I learned to sail on when I was a kid. And this is my mother teaching me how to sail when I was a little boy. And the name of my boat was Help Upside Down. You can barely see that on the stern, but you know that's something that I would need quite a lot as I was growing up. But my mom was a great sailor, my grandfather was a great sailor, and it's been a tradition there at our lakes for a long time. And as I got older, the boats got bigger and they got more beautiful, and I decided that my love of the water, my love of sailing, and my environmental interest were the vehicles that could take me around the world to accomplish my boyhood dream of sailing the world's oceans, even though I was from Iowa. But you have to have somebody that gets you there, right? Because in Iowa, you are as far away from the ocean as you can possibly get. And it's pretty easy for you guys to pop off to the beach, you know, and go do those types of things, but it wasn't that easy for me. And so the question always arises, David, how did you get to the ocean to go sailing? Well, you need a mentor. And for me, it was Captain Roger Swanson. And he was a Minnesota hog farmer. No kidding, he grew up 35 miles from me in southern Minnesota. And very, very accomplished sailor. He's now passed away, unfortunately. But he sailed over 220,000 miles around the planet, and was recognized as the finest offshore voyager of the past three decades. And so I was very fortunate to meet him in life. He became my mentor and a father figure to me, and really taught me about sailing the world's oceans on his beautiful catch named Cloud Nine. And this was a photograph that I took in the Canadian Arctic town of Tuktoyaktuk, which I call Tuktoyototrop. When I'm speaking to kids, because again, you have to go back to tools in the toolbox, and when I speak to kids, I do a whole different program, but you got to have fun when you're talking about these serious issues, so introduce a lot of fun into the conversation that sometimes gets a little bit too serious at times. But you can see how beautiful she's kept, right? So a catch has two masts. You can see a main mast and a smaller mast in the back of the boat. And the boom is the portion that's parallel with the boat. And see how they're perfectly parallel together? Even in the Canadian Arctic, in these faraway places, Roger was a retired Navy seaman. So we kept Cloud Nine pretty shipshape at all times. And this boat was a beautiful sailing vessel, usually with a crew of six, 57 feet. And this is my first time across the Atlantic. I had never sailed on the ocean. So in 1990, I actually interviewed with Roger Swanson, and he asked me to be a crew on the boat. And I said I would absolutely love to. And I said, where do I meet you? And he said, come meet us in Cape Town, South Africa. We're going to do a transatlantic from Cape Town to Ushuaia, Argentina. And I said, well, how do I find you in Cape Town? He goes, just come to Cape Town, you'll find us. And that was a test. So I had to fly into Cape Town and Johannesburg toward the end of apartheid. And they were disappearing journalists at the time. And I roll in with 10,000 frames of film and 40 hours of videotape and all these cameras and all this stuff. And believe me, I got taken into the back room by a bunch of military officials, and I thought it was kind of all over for me. I was going to be gone someplace too. And I had a letter on letterhead from Roger Swanson from Cloud Nine, and I said, before you do anything to me, please read this letter. This is what I'm doing in the country. And they read the letter, and this stern-faced guy with his military uniform and ammunition and machine guns in back of me, he reads this letter and he goes, I know about Cloud Nine. She's been in Durban. She just sailed down the east coast of Africa, and we know exactly where she's been. And she's sitting in Cape Town right now, and if you're sailing on this boat, you're welcome to go. So that's how intelligence works in other countries and around the world. People know what you're doing and what your intentions are. So the power of a good letter can always get you where you need to be. Roger introduced me to the big elements of the world. And after we sailed 6,000 miles in 38 days, I decided I loved it so much that I wanted to go sail the polar regions of the world. And that's what Roger Swanson did. He went to the places where no one else ever went. This is in Antarctica. And it was here at the time in Antarctica that I started learning about the world's weather systems and how the world's weather systems form this big overall climate system that we live in, and how Antarctica's weather affects so much what's going on in the Pacific Ocean, which really drives our weather over North America and affects those farms that I live amongst all the way back in Iowa. So everything is connected, and I started to understand this very well. And also what it was like to be sailing out in these mountains of the world's oceans. And this is near Cape Horn. And I don't necessarily love these types of conditions or storms, but I can tell you that I love photographing the power in these elements of planet Earth. And that's what drives me, is to be out in the world's weather systems to actually see and feel this power so that I can come back and share it with you, because there's something about this that completely affects you and overwhelms you, and then you get a humbling respect for Mother Nature, believe me. This was the first iceberg that I ever saw at sea when we sailed down to Antarctica in 1992, 25 years ago now. I've sailed some 65,000 miles around the planet since that time. And of course, when you're down in Antarctica, this is what makes it all worth it, right? This is the goal. This is the hard work paying off when you finally can get to these areas like the Antarctic Peninsula, where these Adélie penguins live. Now, Adélies, you can always tell because they have a white circle around the eye. There's all the different penguins that we saw at the time, the Gentoo penguins and emperors and things like that. But I love the little Adélies. We got out with the scientists from Palmer Station, the US scientific base down there, and it was the first time I had ever gone with scientists into an extreme region of the world. I'd never had that experience, and I loved it, and it sort of changed my life. And I decided that with my documentary photography, my interest in going to these extreme places, that this is what I wanted to continue doing for the rest of my life. And this is how it feels when you're all alone on a little boat sitting amongst the glaciers. This was a peaceful time for us. We had figured out the safety after being in a bunch of storms. But I had hiked up, so if you're looking across there and you see the big glaciers on the other side of where I am, that's what it looked like, you know, what I was standing on. So again, in order to make that photograph, you have to work, you have to hike, you have to be careful, you have to understand the environment that you're in order to make that photograph and create that feeling of being so small in this world's environment and all alone and vulnerable. But it was during this time when we were in Antarctica that we started talking about the North Polar region, because that's the way Roger rolled, right? He was never content to just stay in one place and say, yeah, made it to Antarctica, Let's go to the Northwest Passage now. So 2 years later, we positioned the boat in the Canadian Maritimes. You can see in the lower right of the screen that we were in Nova Scotia, and then we sailed up to Newfoundland in that little port town of St. Anthony right here. And that's where you begin the Northwest Passage. So you sail out around the ice edge and then up the west coast of Greenland. And in the summertime, the ice starts melting, the ice pack, so it opens up a lead along that shore. So you work up the west coast of Greenland, and then you cross Baffin Bay, and you go into the Canadian islands, this little archipelago that you can see of islands over here. And this is sort of where the Northwest Passage begins, and then you drop south, and then you go over the entire continent of North America through the Bering Strait. I could see Russia through my window. And then sailed down to the Aleutian Islands and eventually into the Pacific Ocean. Now, I say sailing to the Pacific Ocean, but that necessarily didn't work out for us the first time that we tried it. So I'm going to show you a little graphic. This is kind of what it looks like traveling up the west coast of Greenland, 600 miles north of the Arctic Circle, crossing Baffin Bay. You go into Lancaster Sound and then drop south, and then sail over the entire top of North America, and if you're lucky enough, down through Bering Strait, Aleutian Islands, and into the Pacific Ocean, the North Pacific. And this is what it looks like when you beat along, and my bunk was right under the bow. You can see the zodiac that we have on the bow. My bunk was right underneath that in the bow. So imagine what that feels like. We were talking about this earlier. This is the closest you can be to outer space being actually on Earth, because you are pulling G's, and I'm not kidding. You get weight pressed down on you, and then you're absolutely just airborne, and your stomach feels like it's leaving your body. So you have to find ways to sleep in different positions down below deck. And you end up in the strangest sort of sleeping positions you've ever been in your life, with legs up and arms out and elbows in. And I'd use my camera bags and sleeping bags and pad myself, because you're getting juggled all over the place, you know, in the air. And so it's a really difficult environment in which to live and work. And I'm just very lucky that I don't get seasick. And this is something else I talk about. You know, David, you're from Iowa. You've never sailed the world's oceans. How is it you do this? But we all have these genes in us. We all came across oceans in our background. We're all sailors. We're all people of the water. And so I found that I fit naturally on the water, and many of you I know are exactly the same. We don't know what we can be until we actually go into the unknown and explore that part of ourselves and face some of those fears that we all have on a day-to-day basis. So off we went to Greenland. Snowy, icy conditions, treacherous on deck, as you can imagine, very, very slick, and death is literally one step over the rail. You can survive about 2 minutes in the water. And Roger Swanson told us all that if we went over the side, we were dead. You know, there's not really even any reason to try to come back. We have a 30-ton vessel. And with all that inertia, you cannot slow down a boat and get back. And even trying to find you in rough seas is difficult. So it's a very treacherous working condition, and you have to be super careful at all times. But again, the reward of getting to a place like Greenland is the beautiful landscape. And we did a lot of hiking and trekking from time to time in Greenland. And that's it for me. Work hard, get a big reward at the end. And that's the idea of going on an expedition, whether it's a big trek to Mount Everest or something like that. Hard work, hopefully a big eventual reward, and that's what we would constantly be getting. So we worked our way up north, dodging little bergy bits. Bergy bits are fragments of icebergs. There's lots of different names. There's growlers too. Growlers are very dangerous because they can be clear and they kind of float on the surface. They're really slick. You can't see them. They might be the size of this room, and maybe only a couple feet of them are showing at the surface. And they're like landmines out there at all times, so you have to be really careful, obviously, when you're in the ocean. But this was part of the fun, was to solve the, the redolith going through the ice. And on nice days like this, we could pass up close and personal with the icebergs and make some beautiful pictures. I was in a zodiac. And of course, there's 24/7 daylight. So your sleep cycle gets all screwed up and it's hard to sleep and all the stuff that goes with that. You can see my friend Jeff Pope there is in a one-piece work suit. And that's a pretty common form of clothing in the far north. And my friend Jeff Pope, I'll tell you just a little bit more about him in a second, but he was 81 years old. Imagine that, 81-year-old Arctic explorer who went with us one last time to the Arctic. And he had lost his vessel a few years back there in the ice pack off the coast of Greenland. And there were 7 dead men on the boat. And he was rescued by a passing Faroese fishing trawler that just got lucky. One of the crew members kept sending out a mayday on the radio, and a passing fishing boat heard it, came into the ice and rescued them, and risked their lives to rescue them. But his boat sank, and he had built that boat himself with boat builders in Nova Scotia. They've actually felled the trees themselves and built the vessel, and he watched his boat go to the bottom of the ocean. So it's a very dangerous place out there, and this kind of gives you the perspective of the size of icebergs that we were around all the time. And again, it was really fun. Now, one other thing that you'll notice, I don't talk about a lot, but I love being in a kind of more university research setting, because have some of you studied black carbon pollution, aerosols in the atmosphere, industrial pollutants that get carried a long way away through the upper atmosphere and then deposited on ice as dark matter? And when I went out there to these polar regions the first time, I wanted purity. I wanted to photograph the absolute beautiful last places of the planet that hadn't been touched by man. And I didn't know what all of this black substance was on the ice in Greenland. And now I know it's black carbon pollution. And it's the kind of soot and remnants from wildfires and industrial burning of coal and things like that in China. And it started depositing on the ice decades ago and probably triggered the initial melting cycle, the positive feedback loop in the Arctic, because black particles on white snow start attracting, absorbing heat. Instead of reflecting that energy back into outer space, this heat starts getting absorbed and melting the ice. And again, one small effect, cumulative, starts having a big effect. And this positive feedback loop started forming. Once you start melting the ice off the shoreline, it exposes dark water. That dark water starts absorbing the energy as heat, which warms the water, which melts the ice, which opens more dark water, which then melts more ice. And the same thing happens on shore with the bedrock. You start getting the ice melted away from the shorelines, it exposes more bedrock or landmass, and then that heats up, which melts more snow. It's a positive feedback loop, and the big question right now is it stoppable? Can we stop this mechanism from self-feeding? So there's one to study and look up as you walk away. So there's my old friend Jeff Pope at the wheel there, 81 years old. He once took the longest canoe trip ever in the history of the world, 7,700 miles. Left New York City and canoed to Nome, Alaska in 1937 and overwintered with the Indians in the Yukon. Now there's a voyage, right? That's venturing into the unknown. And so he had a lot of stories. He once said he won 37 cents at a keynote table and quit while he was ahead. So he had a lot of good ones for sure. He was our official storyteller aboard, and he was a very good helmsman and friend. This is what our actual chart looked like when we finally crossed into the Northwest Passage. And you can see the route. We're 600 miles north of the Arctic Circle at this point. We're the only vessel in the world making this journey in 1994. And this is what we entered into, a world of unknowns. And we knew the history and what we were up against trying to go through the Northwest Passage. No American sailboat had ever made this east to west passage in history. And this history really came alive for us when we arrived in Erebus Bay and found the graves of the Sir John Franklin expedition onshore there in Beachy Island. These were the first three of 129 men who perished on this expedition. But because of their disappearance, more vessels started coming to the Northwest Passage, and eventually the route was established by Raoul Damundsen, the famous Norwegian explorer, from 1903 to 1906. Imagine 3 years frozen in the ice and four seasons going through the Northwest Passage. Those were some tough dudes back then. These graves are still there. The Canadian government has replaced some of the headstones because the others were getting a little deteriorated. And you'll see a second boat there. The little blue boat, that is a French boat called Back of the Moon. And so we were joined by Back of the Moon. So in 1994, 23 years ago right now, 24, we were nine people and two boats in the entire world trying to go through the Northwest Passage. This is what it looked like for the Franklin expedition. Of course, they had great big vessels and too many men. And the Northwest Passage isn't really a navigable route for big vessels. It's better for small vessels, and I'll get into that a little more later. But they got hopelessly trapped in the ice with their two vessels. They had, as I always say, their vessels were too big. They had too many men. They had bad clothing and terrible food, so a typical British expedition. And they didn't survive, and they refused help from the indigenous culture that had lived there for some 40,000 years, right? So Eskimo, the term Eskimo means eater of raw meat. It's a derogatory term. The better term is Inuit, which means basically the people. And so we're the ones that invented the term Eskimo. And so they considered the Eskimos to be savages. And the eater of raw meat was a savage. So when they were offered food, they didn't really accept it and thought that that was not the way to go. So they had new technology and canned tins with lead solders. And that wasn't a really good way to go for them either. So their demise was kind of preordained in some ways. But it led to the discovery of the Northwest Passage. Well, we thought the same thing might happen to us. And we were kind of hopelessly stuck in the ice also. And we were separated from Back of the Moon completely. And you can see we have lines out there. We're actually tied to ice floes. We drifted with the pack ice at times. We were pinned against the shore at times. We nearly lost our vessel numerous times. And for 2 weeks, we battled this ice, trying to get south into these channels to go through the Northwest Passage. But we just couldn't make it. And like in any expedition, there's a go date and a no-go date. If you're climbing Mount Everest and the weather turns bad and the season changes, doesn't matter if you're near the top or not, it's time to go, and or you're gonna die. And for us, it was the same situation. We were nearing the end of August. We hit our no-go date, and we had to find a way to get out of this ice, because this is a time when the polar ice cap was very different than it is now. Just 23 years ago, we still had over 7 million square kilometers of ice there. So you would have needed an icebreaker to penetrate this ice of the Arctic, and we were a 57-foot fiberglass sailboat. And so this is how we rolled. We were drifting with pack ice, we had grapple hooks and ice climbing screws, and we were just clinging for life there in 1994. I tried to get off the boat when I could to take some pictures, which kind of depicted our struggle that we had in the ice. And at some point, we just had to tuck our tail between our legs and retreat. And so in 1994, we left the Arctic the way we had come in, 3,000 miles in retreat, all the way back out. We sailed around the southern tip of Greenland, hunkered down for a hurricane, and followed its tail all the way across the North Atlantic and ended up in Cork, Ireland. And that was our voyage. So years passed. I did other voyages, but the Northwest Passage sort of kept in my mind this whole time, stayed there. Roger Swanson, it was the same. So now fast forward with me, 13 years. This is when I talk about bridging two eras of exploration. 94, we didn't have laptops, you know? We barely had computers. And most of the computers and this type of thing, the big supercomputers, were held in institutions like Villanova. And scientific knowledge was in the ivory tower. It wasn't really that accessible to the public. And all of a sudden, here comes the internet and laptops, and all of a sudden, I had the same access as kind of a citizen scientist as a scientist had, that we're looking at the satellite information. And I could see a downward trend in the Arctic, and this new concept of global warming and climate change had crept into the public sphere. And I was very curious about this and thought that there was less ice in the Arctic, that we could maybe get through the Northwest Passage. Roger Swanson was 75. This was the only thing he had accomplished. And he said, let's go. Let's give it one last shot before I'm gone. Let's go to the Northwest Passage. So we returned in 2007. And I was very interested in this new concept called ground truthing, where explorers like me could go out and take the satellite data and ground truth, boots on the ground, what the scientists were saying was actual fact, right? Less ice in the Arctic, satellites are saying so, scientists are saying this, researchers are saying this. I want to see this as a citizen. I want to see this as an explorer. So this is what we set off to do. We went by the Jakobshavn ice fjord, the biggest outpouring of ice in the Northern Hemisphere, produces more icebergs than any other glacial system in the Northern Hemisphere, probably the iceberg that sunk the Titanic. It produces enough fresh water daily in the form of ice to supply New York City with its annual fresh water supply. So every single day it's pushing this much ice out into the ocean, and now it's retreated some 20, 30, 40 miles all the way back to the ice edge, to the where the main ice sheet is in Greenland right now, as most glaciers are doing around the world. Jakobshavn is the most studied ice fjord in the Northern Hemisphere, so please take a look at that also. We stopped in cute little towns, like here in Upernavik, and Upernavik is the last provisioning point 500 miles north of the Arctic Circle. This is where we would try to figure out where to navigate the streets of the community. So you can imagine walking around and seeing things like this and trying to go to the grocery store and figuring out what to buy. So anybody want to take a stab at that name? No? Come on. I want to hear it. Somebody. No, no takers. Joe did. Joe said he was the smart one. He can sort of combine the first part and the last part, and he said, looks like Street. So that's what I'm calling it, Street. But I actually went into a grocery store and I got charged with provisioning the boat with a friend, and I thought I was buying something that looked like hot dogs. And when I got to the counter, someone grabbed me by my coat and said, I'm not sure you want to be buying pig's tails. So, I mean, you never know what you're going to get when you're trying to provision a boat in a far-off place. So this is another fun thing when you travel to these places, for sure. And that's a whole other story. But this is where we were most of the time, in these little harbors. And this was a boat called Jotun Arctic that was doing research in the far north. And they had a climate scientist aboard. They were looking at these glacial systems in the far north, and they told us that there was less ice for sure, and that we were not going to have any problem crossing Baffin Bay because they didn't think there was any ice there at all. And so we took off across Baffin Bay, and of course, very rough sailing, but there was no ice, zero ice. Normally there's a northern pack and there's a middle pack, and they split along this line at about 74 degrees, 75 degrees north latitude. And that's been the traditional crossing route for hundreds and hundreds, thousands of years. There's landmarks that you navigate from. You don't even need GPS. Well, now you can just cross Baffin Bay in the summertime because there isn't any ice there anymore. And in 2007, it completely disintegrated. So we had a rough but fast sail all the way across the bay. We entered Lancaster Sound, exactly where we went in before, exact same route, and this is what we found. That the channels were completely wide open and they were completely free of sea ice. The Arctic Ocean was clear. And we arrived back in the exact same place that we were in 1994 when we were stuck in the ice And this is the new environment that we found. We're 500 miles north of the Arctic Circle, and there was no ice whatsoever. It had completely disintegrated and gone away in the summer of 2007. And we were absolutely horrified by what we were seeing as a crew, and profoundly changed and affected by this sight. And so were the polar bears. They were kind of wondering what to do. So put yourself in the polar bear's mind now. Their ice is completely disintegrated. The ice has now moved, in some cases, hundreds of miles offshore. And they were having to make some sort of adaptive choice, whether to swim to the ice edge to find the seals that they feed on, or maybe go back to the family tree of their ancestor, the brown bear, the grizzly bear, and compete for food. And so what are the polar bears going to do? There's another fine point of research study right now. So, I mean, polar bears are obviously an overused icon of the North, but at the same time, it's very interesting to think about this adaptive choice that is going on somehow within their system about what to do. Do you actually think they're making that choice? How do they make the choice? And you're seeing more bears on land now foraging for food, for sure. So they're kind of figuring it out that maybe they can't swim that far anymore. So we sailed through, kept sailing to the west, going through the Northwest Passage day after day, 24/7 daylight, and this is what we saw. Just no ice. It was such a profound experience for me that I was actually changed as a human being. And we eventually made it all the way through. 6,694 miles through the entire Northwest Passage and never touched one piece of ice in the process. We became the first American sailboat in history to ever make this passage. But I feel that there should be an asterisk by our names, because we definitely got an assist from climate change, from a fast-paced changing Arctic climate that just has less ice. So when I speak, I don't like to do a whole lot of charts and graphs. I'll leave that to you research folks. But this is one that I just have to throw in, because this is the trend that I had been looking at. And you can see where cloud nine was in 1994, the first red dot. You can see 7.18 million square kilometers of ice. And you can look back to 1979 when the satellites were first launched, and you can see the same amount of ice. So there is an upward-downward fluctuation. That's normal variability. But what you see happening after this time is not. It is outside of the norms of natural kind of variation and outside of geological time frames of normal climate change, which gives humans, animals, species, plants, time to adapt and change. So between this voyage of 1994 and 2007, I witnessed a 40% loss of ice to our northern polar ice cap, just in that 13-year time frame, and even more by volume. Scientists are estimating that we've lost up to 60%, even maybe more, of our polar ice cap, because we've lost so much old ice. This old ice is kind of the anchor of the northern polar ice cap, because it's a sea, right? It's a frozen ocean versus Antarctica, which is a continent, which has 2 miles of ice on top of it. So the sea is behaving differently than the other polar region. And so what will 2017 have in store? Probably a record loss of ice, because right now, if you've been doing your studying, we're sitting at a record low winter amount of ice. So we're going into the melt season right now already with a considerable amount of damage to our broken Arctic system. We now have a broken Arctic. It's just not behaving like it always has. It is a fractured climate system. The jet stream is wobbling. The jet stream has much more variability in it, and therefore it's now leaking, and it causes tremendous problems now in North America, both in over our continent and over Europe and Asia, depending on how the Arctic oscillation functions. So again, great things to study and take a look at. So this is what I witnessed firsthand. It confirmed exactly what the scientists had been showing me. So with all of this background now, I joined a new expedition because I wanted to lend my voice and efforts to a more science-based and educational-based voyage. And so I joined the Around the Americas expedition. And so I would be the expedition photographer, videographer, ice expert, sailor, watch captain, cook, you know, floor swabber, you know, cleaner, whatever you do, because you got to do everything when you're on a boat. You have to be a jack of all trades, and you have to be able to be useful and help all your mates. So we now were partnered with NASA and NOAA, MIT, Scripps, University of Miami's Rosenstiel School, many universities and educational institutions in the Southern Hemisphere also. We had a K-8 educational program developed in conjunction with National Science Foundation and also with the Seattle-based Pacific Science Center. And we had all our instruments designed by the University of Washington's Applied Physics Lab. So we were a high-tech boat that was completely refit. And we were the smallest going ocean boat in the world that was a NOAA weather ship. We were a fully operational vessel. So we had a NOAA oceanographer with us most of the time, along with many other scientists. 31 different folks interchangeably joined us throughout this voyage. Four sailors, many, many scientists joined us throughout the voyage, but usually we had six on board. So different parts of the ocean, we would have different scientists, educators that were studying this part of the ocean. And every place we would stop, we would be educating. Because now the whole idea was to inspire kids and youth to become educators and scientists and maybe be the ones from this next generation to change the world in a positive way and have this kind of effect on humanity that we all need in this time. So there's the voyage from Seattle all the way in a clockwise motion around the Americas. In all these places we stopped and met with university scientists and turned our boat into an educational lab. And this was the whole purpose. Carbon fiber kayaks, Google cameras on arms, 50,000 images a day, satellite communication, measuring radiative heat into and out of the atmosphere and off the ocean, measuring ocean acidification, through-hull water quality monitoring, and we were a well-equipped small vessel and citizen scientists. We had the kayaks so that we could adventure deep into fjord systems and take a close look up and personal as to what was going on within these fjords and the far off places of the world. They also made for some pretty nice photographs, I might add, so I enjoyed that at all times. And Herb always put on the really nice Kodak red for me, I might add. So many of you who don't know what Kodak is, that used to be film. Some of us don't remember those things, but I certainly do. So anyway, we did all of the science. So you can see we did traditional science. We also, we captured jellyfish, because jellyfish are a key indicator species of this new ocean regime that we're finding out there. They're able to live in a much more acidic environment, and they're a species of opportunity. They move into and out of places that the environment has changed, either the ocean chemistry, the temperature of the ocean, or a predator has changed through overfishing or something like that. We did Arctic buoy support. We launched buoys for the International Arctic Buoy Program. We listened to underwater acoustics. We did aerosol studies with the Microtops program. Cloud observations for NASA, and we were in a NOAA weather ship. So we had all these things going on at the same time all day long. So we had to be citizen scientists, and then we worked with scientists also. We launched probes down into the ocean, like this seabird that could do water sampling through the water column, measuring pH, salinity, and temperature also. Twice a day, we stopped the boat to launch this. And we educated. We would stop every opportunity we could to meet with kids. This is me in the background there speaking on the USS Intrepid in New York City with inner city kids from Harlem through a program called Power of One, where I got to tell my story about growing up in Iowa as a kid, a long way from the ocean. And this is in Chile, where we were making robotic underwater rovers through the MIT program. And this was in Peru. So every opportunity we had, we educated. Kids on board, go to classrooms, and this is how we rolled on Ocean Watch. And of course, then we would go back out to sea. And you can see the blue line kind of on deck there. This is how I work the boat as a photographer. I always had a harness on with a carabiner and a tether with a carabiner on the other end, and I would clip into that system and roll to the bow and back. This is us in Alaska, and finally we were at Barrow. And of course, this is what's happening in Barrow, and Amanda can tell you many more of these stories, but this is what's happening to the shorelines throughout the Arctic. As the permafrost continues to melt and the sea ice melts, there's less ice to buffer this ocean system. So you get a rise in tide, you get less buffered ocean environment with the water being pushed through these basins with wind velocity, and it creates a push, right? So you get change in tide, high tide, then you get higher wave action, you get more ferocious waves because there's less ice, sea buffering, no permafrost, bingo. Tearing apart these little waterfront communities that these Inuit folks have been living on for thousands and thousands of years, that interface between land and ocean. We also got to see bowhead whales up close and personal. I was with the foremost bowhead whale expert in the world, Craig George, and Harry Brower, who comes from a long, long lineage of sustainable harvesting of the bowhead whale for their communities. And it was this interaction of scientists and hunters working together that helped bring the bowhead whale back from the brink of extinction in one of the greatest conservation stories of all time. So please investigate that. We got to see the bowhead whales migrating through these great corridors along the Alaskan coast. And so we often forget that there's animals, there's people living in these far regions of the world, these far off places, and that they need voices, right? It's hard to think about animals having a voice, but animals need a seat at the table too. They need to be represented, and that's important to our humanity, to be able to keep these corridors for the animals that migrate, like the great caribou herds of the far north. We need the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. We need our Serengeti of the north. We also need these places for people, because with the changing Arctic and the climate issue, some of these folks in the far north are becoming some of the first climate change refugees on the planet, because they're having to move entire communities off of these endangered coastal boundaries and further inland to places that are safer from the elements. And of course, we met scientists in the field like George DeVoki, who told me the story about his little bird that he studies. He's an ornithologist who studies the black gila moth on Cooper Island off of Point Barrow, some 30 miles offshore. He's working on his fifth decade now, all alone on this island, so we brought him some supplies. Island is 1 by 3 miles long with a high point of 3 feet, and this is where he lives, in this little bear-proof cabin. He used to live in the tent, now he lives in the cabin. He's had to move into there because the polar bears are swimming and hitting this island now and tearing apart the nest and trying to eat the birds and eat George. And so he works with this little black gila moth and studies it. And so after a couple decades, he noticed that the breeding season was 5 days longer. And he started looking for the indicator that the birds were picking up on. And he discovered that the birds now had a 5 day longer breeding season. And he discovered that it corresponded exactly with a 5 day loss of the snow and ice along the Alaskan Arctic coastline. So he didn't go there to study climate change, he went there to study a little bird. And the bird taught him about this greater climate issue. So that's why doing research is so important. The small thing you might be studying ends up being a great big indicator of a larger, more connected issue. and of course polar bears, because he had not seen a polar bear for 28 years. And now the polar bears were swimming to the island and tearing apart his nest and trying to eat him. So when he asked George if he believes in climate change, he says, no, you don't believe in climate change. Climate change is science. It's just happening. You know, it's chemistry, it's physics, it's what we study as scientists. But I do believe in polar bears. And I know there weren't any polar bears before, and now there are polar bears. They're having to swim, and they're coming to my island. So I believe in polar bears. He also said, if we were watching another planet lose its northern polar ice cap, we would be going, oh my God, look at this planet. It's changing right before our eyes. This is planetary history. And yet here we are losing our northern polar ice cap of planet Earth, and we're still having a debate in the United States as to whether climate change is real. So let's all take a pause and just think about these things for a little bit and the gravity of the situation that we face as human beings on planet Earth. Because this is what George is seeing. This is what his research has taught him. Here's the disappearance of snow and ice. Scientists are having to create new graphs because we're falling off every graph. You know, all of the indicators are showing us either too high, CO2 is going up off the graph, snow, ice is losing, it's going off the graph on the bottom side. So this is what's happening right now across the planet. We continued on. I was up in the spreader where I always am, watching the snow and ice, going through the little bit of ice that we encountered. Out of our 6,000 mile stretch to the Northwest Passage, we encountered 60 miles of ice. And that was actually really exciting for me because I got to be back up on the mast and trying to solve this puzzle of going through the ice, which was kind of great, great fun. And we spent some time doing that. And then, of course, we would stop in little villages again and meet people like my friend Wayne Thrasher, who was an Inuit hunter and fisherman. And he had just gathered his catch for the season. He had caught 300 whitefish, and he was now filleting them out in his little smoke shack back there. And I sat with him as he made his little bucket of Bipsy, which was raw beluga whale and whitefish and fish guts and oil. And I sat with him for 2 days. I didn't take a picture for the first day out of respect for he and his culture, and I had to earn his trust. So I sat there with him. He told me oral histories, and he would dip his knife in there and hand me some of the muck, and I'd suck it off there. And I have the whole gag reflex. And as Joe knows now well, it made me feel like I was gonna puke. And then he thought that was very funny. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. And I earned his trust finally. And so I got to go down into the permafrost ice cave system. So this is in Tuktoyaktuk, where his Inuit community stores their food. This is under the Arctic Ocean. This is literally the Arctic Ocean. This is frozen seawater. This is permafrost. And so this is 30 feet below the surface, and there's 19 rooms. And so this is where Wayne would store his family's food, and other families would do the same that had maintained their traditional culture over the years. And so we went into one of the rooms, and he told me more oral histories about how they're losing these permafrost ice caves throughout the Arctic. Because of the melting permafrost, they're lucky in Tuktoyaktuk. They have a deep system, and it seems to be maintaining itself well. But he feels at a great loss for his culture and his people that are very much in jeopardy in the far north. Well, we continued on through the Arctic ice, 24/7 daylight. We would use these weather windows, and we saved fuel so that we could motor on calm days as the ice pack just continued to disintegrate. And meeting other explorers along the way, like Kevin Tony here, who decided it would be a great idea to go through the Northwest Passage in a 17-foot open boat. So they were rowing and sailing their way through. You can see they're in Crocs and flip-flops. It was 26 degrees. And these guys were tough. They had just had an encounter with a bear on shore. And they thought that was jolly good fun to just about be killed by a grizzly bear. They were on leave, on holiday from the war in Afghanistan. They were British Special Forces guys, and so they thought it would be jolly good fun to go through the Northwest Passage for their holiday, so they were spending 2 years doing that. and they eventually got to Pond Inlet, which was the end of their voyage. So our writer there, Herb McCormick, in the foreground said, if these two were in charge of the British Empire, there would still be one. So this was the kind of fun that we had in the Arctic. And as I talked to Joe a lot about, and you guys too, the impossible and doing the impossible is fun. You know, to challenge yourself, to get out there over that horizon and face your fears and the unknown, because this kind of discovery is what makes it all worth it at the end. It's always a prize to meet these people that if you advertised or laid traps for them, you still couldn't find them in life. So they just kind of appear before your eyes. And of course, finally photographing polar bears in healthy polar bears in nature. This was something that I really wanted to see. This was a mother and probably a two-year-old cub. And we shut off the engines and just drifted. And we got very close to the polar bears. And this was an absolutely wonderful and profound experience for me to be in this environment. And just remember too, in your climate discussions, this great big issue that we all face in our shared humanity, that we still live on this beautiful, beautiful planet. And getting out there and exploring and photographing is what took me out there in the first place. And stop and pause in these moments of beauty and really relish and cherish them, because we do live in a beautiful world. So get out there and explore your backyard, your areas around here. Take those times, because it's good for all of us and our humanity to do so. Because this is what takes me out there, is to find these beautiful elements of nature and to bring them back and share the stories of our shared common humanity on this planet. Because it's in these moments that I find myself. I find the beauty, the spirituality, the peace that can only be found in these beautiful, special places at the ends of the earth. And I want them to be there for your younger generation to go see, just like I've been able to go out in the outdoors and experience a healthy, sound environment for future generations of explorers to come and scientists to go out there and study, not just the destructiveness of human activity that's taking a toll on the planet, that by common shared good, we can have a positive change and effect on this planet if we go about it in new and more sustainable means and methods. So once again, we went through the Northwest Passage from west to east this time, and in doing so, I became the first and only American sailor in history to ever accomplish the Northwest Passage in both directions. And it sort of leads me to my last slide and thoughts, and that's that these years that I've been out sailing, I really feel like I've bridged two eras of exploration. That I wrote in my journal that the golden era of exploration has come to a close. You know, the Shackletons and the Amundsens and the Franklins and all of these great explorers, the Perrys, you know, these folks that went out there to look at the first, do many first things around the planet. We've now discovered all of these geographical points. And we've now gone into this next era of exploration, and that is the study and change of the Earth's climate systems. This era is just beginning, and we're all pioneers in this room. We're exploring the world in new ways now. And me as an explorer and a photographer, whenever I go out into the world, I'm now looking to document, to collect data, to document through photography changes or things that I can bring back to help tell stories of our shared common humanity. And that's what I'm trying to work on with Joe and with GeoVersive, to find new ways to communicate, share our stories, empower people through narratives, through research, through different ways to solve our problems with new civics and new engagements of humanity and people engaging in one another in ways that are more peaceful. And I think the climate change issue is that issue. It's the one thing that binds us all together. You cannot get away from it. And to me, it's a catalyst toward peace. And that's what I want to find in the world. And I hope that we get there, especially for all you younger people in the world, because I don't want to leave this damaged planet to you. I want to help be a catalyst toward peace and healing. So with that, I thank you all very much for having me.